Everybody, welcome to the front. I am your humble host, AI, also known as Darren. You'll hear that name a lot tonight from my special guest, Mr. John DiNardo. We'll be talking some more Planet X, extreme weather, climate change, what's causing it, and where we're headed with it. But first of all, let me thank all you free thinkers and evolutionaries. Thank you for tuning in to the front. If you're listening to this broadcast, you are the resistance. We are broadcasting to you live, as usual, from deep inside FEMA Region 1. All you kids out there don't know your FEMA regions? Look it up. I'll give you a hint. It's New England. All right. Before we get rolling, John should be calling in anywhere from 2 minutes after to 10 minutes after. We'll see what happens with that. I have blocked off 2 solid hours for the program this evening, and I don't know if we'll use them all, every single minute that we have blocked off, but it's there for our use, and hopefully it will be a good show, interesting show, and the 2 hours will fly by. First of all, let me just say hello to everybody listening out there. I appreciate you guys tuning in and taking the time to delve into subjects such as this. It could save your life one day. I hope it doesn't come to that, but signs are pointing that it possibly could. Tonight, I'll be taking some questions in chat. I'm going to save them for our guest, Mr. John DiNardo. I'm going to give him the opportunity to present his material. When he's ready to take questions, we will do that. I think I have him on the line right now, and I'm going to let him introduce himself. So we're going to pick up the phone, and hopefully this is John.
Hey, Darren. It's a pleasure being with you and your audience.
Hey, John. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time. And want to get this message out here. And were you listening to the program just now?
No, I was not. I just called in.
Oh, okay. I just was explaining to the listeners that, you know, we have 2 hours blocked off, commercial free, and I don't know if we'll use all that time, but it's there for us if you, you know, if we want to use it. So I didn't even get a chance to introduce you properly. I've informed everybody you know, who you are as far as your name and what we're going to be discussing, but did not get a chance to tell them your background. So maybe you just want to give us your background a little bit, and then we'll get right into it.
Okay. I gained my electronics experience in the U.S. Marine Corps. Then I went on to get a bachelor's degree after being discharged from the Marine Corps. I got a bachelor's degree in science education, specializing in physics. Taught high school physics for a couple of years, and then went on back into the field of electronics, working at numerous corporations in various aspects of electronics, gaining experience in troubleshooting and fault analysis, and then on to engineering, electrical engineering, and electronic circuit design. So after working with a number of electronics companies, I went to Bell Laboratories, Bell Telephone Laboratories, and spent 20 years there as an electrical engineer, engineering technician, and electronic circuit designer. After that, my career ended. Essentially, I retired, took an early retirement, and became enamored with the concept of Planet X. I heard about Planet X way back in 2002, and I had, for some reason, I think I had a spiritual understanding. I didn't know why, because I didn't know why I understood it to be true, or it was a spiritual discernment. Even though I had no knowledge whatsoever about it, when I first heard about it, I knew that it was absolutely true, and therefore went on to study all the information surrounding Planet X, and I've been involved in that ever since. Off and on, I have a radio program, the title of which is Planet X in Bible Prophecy. It's on shortwave radio 3185. That's 3185 shortwave Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's okay. Also simulcast on that's radio station's website, which is WWRB.
Okay. You're also on the Orion Network with me as well, I think, right? Sundays?
I just recently started on the Orion Network, and that's correct. Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Okay, excellent. I broadcast Saturdays at 2 o'clock, just did my fourth show. I was going to see maybe if you wanted to join me at early afternoon show one time, you know, because a lot of these, this type of programming is done in the evening, so, you know, maybe a Saturday afternoon crowd might be a good thing to do. Just something to think about.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'm always grateful for the opportunity to bring this vital information to people who are interested and want to know so that they can protect themselves. So I think this has become a calling in my life, actually, and many of us, you and others too.
Right.
The idea of educating people so that they can protect themselves from the disasters that are coming. And we need to know, first of all, that no one who is talking about Planet X wants to scare anyone. What we all want to do is prepare, not to scare, but to prepare.
Right.
And that your life can be saved. We have to admit, we have to be honest that many millions and probably billions of people will be killed in the coming disasters, but there's a spiritual relationship with God that will bring people safety, that God promises in His scriptures to bring people to safety who call out to Him. And also there are of course many physical things, material measures that we can take to protect ourselves. And I'd like to talk about that too, just a little bit in the beginning, to give people hope and not to discourage them or frighten them. One of the things we can do is to look into the idea of dome homes. A dome home or any kind of dome structure, even if it's only about, say, 12 or 13 feet in diameter, when laid down and buried slightly in the ground, will resist winds up to 200 miles an hour. At least this is what I've been told. So we can look into that. There are companies that we can find across the country that do make dome homes or dome structures that can be assembled. So that's one idea.
Do we have time for that, though, John, in your opinion?
Probably don't.
Okay.
I thought you meant for this. Yeah, I know what you mean. We do have time. Actually, if the structure is not real big, I would never go into the undertake such a large project as building a home as a dome. But there are structures that are perhaps 12 feet in diameter or can be modular types of structures that are broken down, and you can order them in pieces, lightweight material that can be constructed and put together in form, say, a dome maybe about 12 to 15 feet in diameter, where you and your family, if you have a four-member family or even a six-member family, can lay down inside of that dome outside your house during times when there are severe storms. Of course, the house, you know, it's very difficult to talk about these things, but under extremely heavy winds, like 90 miles an hour, 90, 100, 120 miles an hour, roofs get blown off of houses. And, you know, there are things I like to talk about also regarding that. I just recently had a new roof put on my house last year, and it was the second roof because the house is only like 20 years old. So they say you can tack on a new set of shingles on top of the first set of shingles, but you can't tack on a third set. It's just too much. They have to strip off all the old shingles and put on a new set. But what I did was I got the highest wind resistant shingles that you can get. Secondly, I looked very hard to find only one roofer who's been in the family. His family business has been in operation since 1905. He even showed me the picture of the roofing truck in 1905, where his great-grandfather started the roofing business. And he is a member of the old school of roofing, where they use copper nails. They use a hammer and nails, because these guys with staple guns will go as fast as they can, and they'll go like boom, 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 like a machine gun.
Yep.
With the staple or the nail guns on the roof, and this roofer, this experienced roofer, told me that if you miss that particular line where you're supposed to put the nail in, what is going to happen is the shingle is going to come off very easily with even a moderate windstorm. And that's what's happening. He said he does not want to come back and replace shingles. He's been through that. So he makes sure that his guys only use a hammer, even though everybody else is doing it cheaper. I spent $1,000 more And it was worth it to have this roof put in that will be much more wind resistant than the other cheaper roofs that you get. Make sure the guy uses a hammer and copper nails. He says if you use galvanized nails, even the galvanized, you can throw them into a bucket of water, and after a couple of weeks or a couple of months, that galvanized nail is nothing but a shell of the galvanized material. All the metal inside is rusted away. So
right.
He uses only copper nails. Anyway, it sounds like a triviality, but when you're going to protect your roof from getting blown off, it's the most important thing in the world to know.
Trivial until your roof comes off, and then you're wishing you did it.
That's right.
You know, you're mentioning 90-mile-an-hour winds. I had John Moore on the program, and he was talking about 200-mile-an-hour winds. So I don't know what roof would stay on with that. I'm kind of thinking basements might be the best place, especially. Well, I guess it depends on the structure of your home, but I think I understand, you know, wanting to give people some measures of hope. Is there anything as far as geographical locations that you think might be advantageous to people?
From what I've heard, there's really no place that's going to be really safe, except in general, it's good to stay away from the shorelines. Well, probably when the tsunami depending on what's going to happen, for example, it's almost a foregone conclusion that there will be a major tsunami as a result of the Cumbre Vieja volcanic mountain situated on the island of La Palma in the Canary Island chain off the west coast of Africa. That island, I have a BBC and a Discovery Channel documentary, which is a wonderful documentary. They play it very often because I think they're trying to warn people to take note, to take heed. But in this documentary, they show, they feature Dr. Simon Day and Dr. Bill McGuire, stationed on the island of La Palma in the Canary Islands. These men are from the British London College in England, and they're doing extensive geological studies on this island of La Palma. And what they note in this DVD, which I have myself, I try to distribute it to people, they show you that the western flank of this island off the west coast of Africa is entirely separated. This is a 500 billion ton western flank of the island. It's completely separated by a margin of about 13 feet, so it's not connected at all to the island proper. And they say that water is trapped in there from the rains that come in that margin. And when that volcano begins to heat up, and what's going to happen is that water will become vaporized and turned to steam. And as you know, steam is a powerful force that generates all of our electricity.
Yeah.
Steam is extremely powerful. And when that steam begins to be created in the margin of that flat western 500 billion ton flank of mountain, it will be like putting a brick on the top of a sliding board and then putting a lot of oil and grease underneath the brick and watching it slide down that oil greased sliding board. The mountain 500 tons will slide into the ocean, and the Fritz Hermann is a scientist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. He's also featured on this documentary. He says that there are small model studies and there are computer-generated studies show that conservatively that this mountain will displace far more volume than its actual volume because it plunges into the deep waters. And as a result, it will generate a tsunami which will have an initial height, initial wave of about two Empire State Buildings.
Wow.
In height. But of course, now that initial wave will level off and become a very long, extended tsunami wave, travel across the ocean. Their estimation, their studies show that it will take about 8 hours to go from the western coast of Africa in the Atlantic Ocean across westward to the east coast of the Americas, North America, South America, including Canada. Take about 8 hours to reach those coasts. It will destroy all the major cities along the coast, Boston, New York, Atlantic City, Norfolk, Miami, etc., all the way down through South America. Also, it'll take about 3 hours to reach Portugal and England. So we have to be alert to this, and one of the measures, protective measures that we can all take is to have people, teams of people, people like your listeners, get together and on blogs, and we have various Yahoo groups, like there's Earth Changes, there's one called Survive PX, which is means Survive Planet X. Try to find a Yahoo group, Survive PX, and involved in that, I would advise your listeners. Because when you do, you can help to warn us about any possible eruptions of the Cumbre Vieja, that's C-U-M-B-R-E-V-I-E-J-A, Cumbre Vieja Mountain. When that thing starts to heat up, we want to get away from the coast. I mean, I live in northern New Jersey, about 40 minutes west of New York City. And what we need to do is monitor that volcano. There's a website called Volcano Live, and incidentally, I guess I'm spelling a lot of things for your listeners so that maybe they can jot down, get a pen and paper and jot down some of these words, because you're going to forget all the information that I have to throw out to you. And if you jot it down, you can look it up and then really get active. There's a website called Volcano Live, volcanolive.com, and it may not be the only one. There are other websites too. But when you go to Volcano Live, click on Breaking News, and you might do this, you know, a couple times a week, or more often. It just takes a minute to go there and look at all the different volcanoes that are getting active around the world, and just look for the Cumbre Vieja, because when that volcano goes, that's when the East Coast may go. Now, you can't sell your house in a day or two, obviously, when you suspect that volcano is starting to erupt. But you can certainly pack your stuff in a car, pack up some essential items that you may have already prepared in advance. Right. Get in the car, take the kids and the wife, and drive west, take a day trip. And a lot of times you may take a day trip and find out that nothing happened, hopefully. You may take a lot of day trips. You may use up a lot of your vacation days, but you could save your life by just doing that. Because if you wait till when they say, all of a sudden you find out from the news, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, the whole world is asleep, you're sound asleep, and you get a news report on the television, which is off, so you don't even know what's happening. But there, the buoys in the Atlantic Ocean have detected a tsunami, a huge tsunami, headed toward the east coast of the United States and South America and Canada. And it's going to arrive in, say, 3-4 hours. It's hopeless. No one is going to be able to jump out of bed and jump in their cars and get out of there, because you'll have gridlock in a matter of minutes, gridlock on the highways, and people will be dying on the roads.
Right, and that's why you're saying monitor this volcano. This volcano, so you have plenty of warning.
Yes, absolutely. You want to get out a day in advance before everybody else knows. Now, I tried putting out articles warning people, trying to organize a group of us so that we could help to have an early alert system along the East Coast, and this is still feasible. This can still be done. My idea was this back in 2005. I put out a long essay, which maybe I should dig up from my old files and repost and send to you and others. But in that essay, I showed all the evidence of this volcano, that it will absolutely, definitely erupt, probably over the next year or so, because of Planet X and the heating that it's causing within the Earth's outer core, molten iron outer core. But my plan in this essay was to get people such as emergency medical personnel, you know, EMTs, and find various blog sites and websites and Yahoo groups specializing in emergency medical personnel and people who are, you know, the kind of people who will come to the aid of others in an emergency. And that would be like firemen, EMTs, maybe you can think of others too, you know, police or whatever, who can get involved in all this, because the police must realize that they're going to have a tremendous burden on their backs. So they're going to want to warn others too. But if we can blog about this and discuss ways of having an early warning system so that we can predict a day in advance and put out the warning to the entire East Coast a day or two in advance, whenever we see the Cumbre Vieja beginning to heat up and smolder in smoke, we can warn tens of millions of people, maybe, if we get an organized group together, because the government is not going to do it.
No.
The government actually doesn't want to panic anybody. They don't want to risk their money. And this happened before in the past. They don't want to risk their precarious, fragile economic system.
I think more than that, they don't want to take a chance on losing control.
Exactly. That's another major reason. In fact, you hit a major psychological point there. That's why they never want to warn us about disasters, because see, and what you're implying is that they rule by fear. You know, we will. In other words, they threaten to punish us if we disobey their dictates.
Exactly.
However, when you see a disaster coming from the sky, you see meteors, you see earthquakes, the government be damned. That's the attitude that people take. I'm going to go out and take care of my family. I'm going to get water. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to take care of my family. And I don't care about the law. Well, the government knows that. The ruling controllers know that. So therefore, they will try to keep you ignorant. And the second reason why they will not tell you is because they, in fact, want to see people die. Now, this has been proven by the Georgia Guidestones. They've actually written it in stone, almost like their Ten Commandments, that we want to kill. We want to bring down the population of the world to 500 million.
Yeah. Maintain a population of 500 million, yeah. And you know, that's really what got me onto Planet X. Well, I was actually first turned on to it because I read an email by a man named Lonnie. I'm sure you've heard of Lonnie.
Yes.
Once I read that, I started, you know, thinking, because up to that point, I really covered the globalist agenda, New World Order, that whole thing. And when I read that email, whether I thought it was true or not, it still dovetailed in with Georgia Guidestones came to mind immediately, because I'd always thought, how would they actually pull this off? I mean, you hear, you know, programs like Alex Jones and things like that, and they talk about, you know, viruses being let out in the public, terrorist attacks to help bring down population. But you're talking, you know, major depopulation, and I don't think that any controlling factor could really pull that off without a major pushback from the masses. And that's when I really started taking the thought of a natural event as being, you know, a fairly legitimate scenario.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people have stated that. Even Mark Hazlewood said that way back in 2002 when he was the only person talking about Planet X, giving speeches about it and doing radio interviews. He said the New World Order is not planning to kill you. They're waiting for Planet X to come by and do the job.
Right, and I think that the true New World Order would happen after an event such as that. You know, because if you think about them being in their dumbs, you know, their underground bases, they're gonna have a fairly large advantage over anybody that, you know, tried to make it, you know, just on the surface. Those who actually survive that will be at a pretty big disadvantage technologically and probably in pretty much every way compared to anybody who makes it down into one of those, you know, extravagant bases.
That's right. That's what they have planned. The ruling elite have had this strategy planned for many years. They've been building these underground cities at the cost of trillions of dollars. It's just amazing the technology they're using to tunnel through the ground. It's actually so hot. It creates such heat, from what I understand from Dr. Deagle. These machines are actually nuclear-powered, and they actually bore a huge tunnel through the underground rock. And the rock gets so hot that it becomes glazed. The inner walls of these tunnels become glazed like glass from the heat. But anyway, they do have these elaborate tunnel systems in all the major nations, in the U.S., in Russia, in Britain, in Israel. And Governor Jesse Ventura actually went underground recently and filmed an entire one-hour special on True TV, which I recorded, titled Apocalypse 2012. So you can go to YouTube and just type in Jesse Ventura, Apocalypse 2012, and you'll get all the parts, the segments of that broadcast. He went down into the bowels of Cheyenne Mountain below the Denver airport, and and it was, they actually allowed him under there. It was amazing. He interviewed, or his producer, Michael Braverman, spoke to the Colonel Wynn, who was the chief of security down there, and they showed some of the troops down there, heavily armed troops, in below Cheyenne Mountain. And when Michael Braverman asked Colonel Wynn, well, do you have a place for us when the disasters occur? And Colonel Wynn said, those multi-ton steel doors will be slammed shut well in advance, and you can knock all day long. You're not getting in.
I also believe he said, the people that contributed to this project will be here. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I didn't get an opportunity to send my contribution in, you know.
But you did. It was your taxes.
Ah, but they didn't tell me where that was going. I thought it was going to fix my roads in my school.
I mean, it's really horrible. I mean,
it is.
So anyway, that's what's happening, and people need to know about it. But our hope is that we can warn enough people that they can protect themselves. And remember, there is a God who cares about us and who loves us and who promises in the scriptures to protect us. And he also promises to go after those evil ruling powers who are trying to exterminate us and try to save their lives. Well, God promises in the scriptures, he says in the book of Obadiah, they can climb as high, they can go to the stars, or they can go underground, as he says in the book of Revelation, but I'm going to get them. He says he's going to get them and root them out and punish them. So we have a God, a great God, who's on our side, and he loves us, and he will promises to, in the book of Joel, for example, 800 B.C., he promises that even though there's going to be smoke and fire, pillars of smoke, and a great day of darkness, the day of the Lord will come, he says, where great destruction will occur. But he says, anyone who calls out my name, the name of the Lord, will be saved. So this is the greatest hope that we have. But going on, what I'd like to do now, Darren, is there's a thousand different facets to this huge ball of evidence, believe it or not. Each facet has a story in itself. And what I'd like to do is if your people, your listeners, would like to just jot down some of these key words, and then they can come back and ask questions on some of these headlines, because I only have time initially to read the headlines. I want to try to cover as many of the facets as possible by simply identifying them briefly, and then having listeners call in, or maybe I can myself go back and elaborate on each of the individual facets. But I'm going to try to read off this list that I put together today, and I didn't even have enough time in about 4 hours this afternoon. I was still deficient in the required time to write down every single little headline identifying each of the facets of information, but I got a good many of them written down. I'm going to start reading them off now. If people would like to jot down keywords that so that they can come back later and ask questions. So these would be just brief outlines.
Sure.
I'll run through them. The movies. In the movies, there are numerous movies that have hints about the coming disasters on planet Earth. One of the movies is the movie Knowing with Nicolas Cage. K-N. The movie Knowing, spelled K-N-O-W-I-N-G, in the movie, the theme of it is that great solar scorching will occur. The Earth will become scorched with fire. And this, in fact, is something that we see coming. It's been in the scriptures, and it's being revealed to us by the National Academy of Sciences and also the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, have reported that there will be solar scorching in 2012.
Yes, I reported on that article that came out in the Huffington Post about a month ago, on that report that was released from NASA, NOAA, and the National Academy of Science. It was actually put in mainstream on the Huffington Post, and they actually mentioned a brown dwarf in there in the third page of the article.
Oh, I'm glad you. I didn't even know about that. I'm glad you brought that
up. I'll send it to you.
Good.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah, anytime you can fill in, interject with some information that might fill in what I'm talking about, that would be appreciated.
Okay.
Let's see. Dr. Michio Kaku is a famous astrophysicist that you see on television. He used to be on the radio quite a bit. Dr. Michio Kaku, K-A-K-U, he's been on, you can go to YouTube and find him on Fox News, where he says, look, I didn't say this. This came from the National Academy of Sciences and NASA. They are saying that there's going to be solar scorching in 2012 that would burn up, very likely, burn up the power grids.
Yes, actually, I think he did that when he was talking with Shepard Smith. Was it Shepard Smith?
I just saw
that bit a couple weeks ago. So yes, and the host, if it was Shepard Smith, I can't remember if it was him or not, he acted like he wasn't taking it all that seriously. and maybe that was him putting on a front for the cameras, I don't know, but the guy that you're talking about, the scientist, he was definitely serious about it.
Yes, and then getting back to Jesse Ventura, incidentally, it reminds me that in that Jesse Ventura True TV broadcast about Apocalypse 2012, you'll recall that Larry Joseph, the scientist Larry Joseph, was on there, and he was saying the same thing to Governor Ventura. He said, you know, it's not me, Governor. It's here, I'm going to show you the articles, and they actually showed clippings of the newspaper articles and magazine articles from the National Academy of Science and NASA stating that we will have solar scorching in 2012. Let's see, what else? He said what happened is Larry Joseph went on to explain that in 1859, way back then, like over 150 years ago, all they had in the way of power lines was telegraph lines. That's all they had in their technology. But those telegraph lines were sizzled. And, of course, it didn't destroy the technology or the civilization at that time, because everybody lived basically off the land and it was a primitive situation, primitive civilization. Now, of course, everything is totally different. We have power grids that will be damaged. The power, we will have no power when this solar scorching occurs. That will also destroy lots of sensitive electronic equipment that we use for commercial purposes, that are major satellite stations, receiving stations, basic hub computers, and big systems like that will be destroyed, not to mention our home electronic systems too, which are all connected to the power grids.
Let me throw a question, John, unless you want to finish this.
No, go ahead.
Okay. With knowing that that the sun can definitely knock out our grid, or even just parts of it. Well, actually, I just a report came out today. I saw it on Drudge. It said electric power grid failures are up 124% since the early 90s. If we're going to count on some early warning systems, I get a little nervous that, you know, there may not be those systems around to warn us, although the power being out itself is a warning. You know, I get that, but I'm saying as far as, a tsunami like we talked about earlier, what do you think? Do you have any idea about the order of events or anything like that? I know it's hard to speculate, but...
It's hard to speculate, but I can see one thing that's coming. I mean, as far as the tsunamis, we don't know when that volcano is going to heat up. But we do see solar scorching, you know, coming down the line pretty soon.
Do you think that'll happen over the entire planet, or is just parts of it?
The entire planet. Of course, you know, the poles are, you know, you get closer to the North and South Pole, they won't be quite as hot, but there'll be tremendous melting, you know.
And how will that how will that scorch the entire planet? Will it kind of wrap? I'm not a physics guy, and I'm not, you know, I'm just delving into the whole astronomy aspect of this and what goes on in space, but will the waves from the sun, the electromagnetic waves from the sun, wrap around the Earth and cause that solar scorching around the whole planet? Is that how that would work?
They will hit the part, the section of the Earth that would suffer the most will be the sun's face of the Earth that's facing
the sun
at that time when the solar blasting occurs. If the solar blasting lasts, of course, it's going to last for several hours. By then, the Earth will have rotated, every 6 hours, the Earth rotates one-fourth of a full revolution. You know, most of the Earth will get it if the solar blasting, coronal mass ejections last long enough, and they usually do. I don't know how long they last, but just to give you a little background, there are two kinds of emissions from the sun. emissions, and one of them is a coronal mass ejection, which is primarily protons, which are hydrogen nuclei missing their single valence, lacking their single valence electron. So it becomes an ion. It's a positively charged particle, and it's blown out in all directions, usually in all directions, when it's a coronal mass ejection. We just had a coronal mass ejection last week, and it caused a number of earthquakes. But when these coronal mass ejections go out, it's like throwing a rock in the center of a placid pond. The rippling occurs, results from throwing a rock in the center of a pond, and the rippling goes out in all directions. You see circles within circles enlarging, getting larger and larger until the initial wave, circular wave, reaches the shore. Well, that's what happens when the sun blows out a coronal mass ejection. There are waves of these positively charged protons, this is what's called plasma, electrified gases, that take about two or three days to reach Earth. And when they do, you can expect earthquakes. You can expect, if it's bad enough, but you can expect a destruction, damaging of our Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is like a football player's face mask. It protects the face from getting injured. Same thing with
right.
The magnetic field. It protects our Earth from being damaged by these electric particles. We saw auroras, very extraordinarily large auroras during this last week's coronal mass ejection, which struck Earth. And the reason is all these particles, what they do is they follow the lines, these charged particles follow the invisible vertical lines of the Earth's magnetic field, which wrap around the Earth sort of like the vertical wire bars of a birdcage. Visualize a rotating birdcage with those vertical, thin golden vertical bars or wires surrounding the cage. Well, that's what we have. Something like that is our Earth's magnetic field with invisible wires wrapped around it. And this magnetic field interacts with electric particles. And as a result, the particles then flow right along the lines to the north and to the south. So you have what's called the aurora borealis in the northern hemisphere and the aurora australis in the southern hemisphere. And then we had the auroras were extraordinarily powerful, strong, and bright. They were seen all the way down as far south as Iowa, from the North Pole all the way down to the state of Iowa, which is really unusual. So that indicated that we had a huge coronal mass ejection that hit our Earth's magnetic field. And, of course, it weakens and breaks down the Earth's magnetic field, because when you electrically interact, you're putting energy, electrical energy from the sun is blasting the Earth's magnetic field, and that energy feeds back inductively. It's a magnetic feedback that goes back into the Earth's core and disorients the regular flow of the molten iron magnetic material, the molten iron material inside the Earth's outer core. We depend upon that, the regular flow of that molten iron, to give us a nice, strong, firm magnetic field surrounding the Earth like a huge balloon, sort of like a huge balloon would have a billiard ball enclosed within it. And that balloon, that Earth's magnetic field, gets damaged in the outer cores. Or magnetic flow, electric flow orientation gets disoriented every time we get blasted with a coronal mass ejection. Then, of course, we get solar flares, too. Now, solar flares are a different type of energy. They're not actual tiny particles.
Yes. John, just so you know, we had another CME yesterday, an M1 class, but not directly heading to us, but kind of like glancing off of us.
No, that's so far, but how long can you be lucky when you have bullets being thrown at you or dodgeballs being thrown at you? Sooner or later, you're going to get hit. Larry Joseph had mentioned, too, in this Jesse Ventura broadcast on True TV, he had said that, and he showed these five Themis unmanned satellites were sent out by NASA. The word Themis, you can look that up on the Internet, T-H-E-M-I-S. EMIS. Five of them were sent out, and fortunately, luckily, they happened to be going out from the Earth into space, passing through the surrounding magnetic field of the Earth at a particular time, just when the Earth's magnetic field broke open, busted open like a balloon would burst, in a sense. And it was a big hole in the Earth's magnetic field. And these Themis satellites flew right through this hole in the Earth's magnetic field. And that indicated to all the scientists that this could really be a serious problem if these holes in the magnetic field worsen. Anyway, we have the solar flares, which are energy, high energy, I think it's X-rays or ultraviolet, but it's electromagnetic radiation. It's not particles, but it's actual energy. And it's all considered electromagnetic, of course. It depends on what the wavelength or frequency is, whether it's considered gamma radiation or ultraviolet or what. But anyway, we have this sort of electromagnetic. It's the same type as light, as visible light, only it's higher frequency. And that strikes Earth. Of course, it travels a lot faster. We're talking about solar flares now, the electromagnetic energy that is blasted out by solar flares as opposed to coronal mass ejections, which are particles. And as we learn at school, it takes about 8 minutes for light from the sun to reach Earth. So instead of taking 2 or 3 days for a coronal mass ejection to reach Earth, it takes only about 8 or 10 minutes for a solar flare to hit Earth. Well, anyway, getting away from the technical, getting back to some of these bullet headlines here.
Can we talk about the amount of activity that the sun is producing lately? I mean, I watch it every day. I look at news about the sun actually a few times a day. This month compared to last month, drastic difference.
Much, much increased, right?
Yes, much more increased. Exactly.
Well, back in 2008, 2009, I guess I should start from back around year 2000. In the year 2000, there was a solar maximum. And, you know, scientists can always predict these solar maximum activities when the sun is going to be hyperactive. It's once every 11, about every 11 years, it takes 11 years for the sun to build up, let me start from this. It takes 11 years for the huge planet Jupiter to make one revolution around the sun. So one Jupiterian year is actually 11 years. Well, when Jupiter revolves around the sun, it reaches a point where in its orbit where it's closest to the sun, and then it reaches a point in its orbit, the other half of its orbit, where it's furthest from the sun. The point closest to the sun is called perihelion. Peri meaning close, helion meaning sun. And then in the other half of its 11-year cycle, it reaches aphelion, which means away from the sun, farthest from the sun. So 5.5 years it takes to get to the peak. Well, in 2001, the sun was at a solar maximum.
Is that why the sun has these maximums and minimums? Is it resulting on Jupiter's orbit?
That's right, because Jupiter, just like any other planet or any other celestial object, when it gets close to the sun, it will cause arcing and sparking. It causes electrical excitations and also gravitational excitations of the sun. And Jupiter is so large, and this is an important point to remember because we're going to talk about it more often. That is that the mass of Jupiter is 318 Earth masses. 318 Earth masses is the mass of Jupiter. Jupiter is almost not quite large enough to be what's called a baby star or a brown dwarf star. A brown dwarf star is really a baby star that never got big enough to light up. So it's like a baby dark star. That's what a brown dwarf star is. Well, Jupiter is maybe one-third of a baby, one-third or one-fifth or one-tenth of a baby brown dwarf star. Planet X is a brown dwarf star, which means that Planet X is much larger than Jupiter. Which means that translates to much larger than 318 Earth masses.
And that's why we're seeing more extreme sun activity at this point.
Yes, right.
I equate what's happening with the sun right now when I try to talk to people about this is, think of it like a volcano when it starts to smoke, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of rumbling right now, in my opinion. Do you think that's a decent analogy about what's happening with the sun?
Yes, for sure. You know, like in 2000, we were expecting, we normally should have had gradually reducing solar activity because Jupiter had passed its perihelion, its closest approach to the Sun in 2000, year 2000. And then from 2000 on, we expected it to move away from the Sun for the next five and a half years, 2005 and a half, reach aphelion, where there would be minimal solar activity. So in 2005 and a half, we expected a minimum. However, what happened was totally contrary to that, to the expectation. What happened was that the Sun just kept on getting more and more hyperactive from 2000 through to 2005 and reached extraordinary levels of hyperactivity up until 2007. And then all of a sudden, the Sun, almost like a light switch, switched from very bright and very hyperactive and flaring and coronal mass ejections to extremely quiet. Record-breaking quiescence of the Sun. We couldn't understand it for 100 years or more. The Sun had never gone so quiet. No, a complete absence of sunspots from 2007 to 2009. Nobody knew why. I looked and looked on the internet. I couldn't find any explanations for it. But I theorized that in 2009, Planet X was flying, coming into our solar system, approaching the ecliptic plane of our solar system. So our solar system is like a huge compact disc, a huge CD, okay, if you will, with the hub of the CD, and you put the CD on your seat, on your player, and you put it, the whole of the CD into the hub. We'll visualize that hub as the Sun. And the planet X, I mean, our ecliptic is like an invisible disc in space. And on that invisible disk, it's like a circular track where all the planets orbit around the Sun. Well, Planet X was coming in, as we know from many different scientists over the years, we know that Planet X is coming in from below this invisible disk called the ecliptic plane. And it's approaching us. And in fact, you know, I think it's really important because it's hard to visualize it. I'm going to ask your listeners, if they will, if they can get a rubber band and a coin like a quarter, or any kind of coin, actually a large coin. Or if you don't have a rubber band and a quarter, just visualize this. You take the quarter in your hand between your thumb and your, hold it between your thumb and your index finger horizontally so that the coin is horizontal. Your index fingernail is pointing up and your thumb fingernail is pointing downward. Now you take the rubber band and loop the rubber band over the top of your index fingernail and then stretch the rubber band down at an angle along the inside of your forearm. Now if you're not actually doing that, you can probably visualize it. That rubber band describes the orbital path of Planet X. And the quarter represents the portion of the solar system, the invisible disk, where the edge of the quarter, very edge of the quarter, is like just near Jupiter. Now that rubber band loops over the top of your fingernail. The top of your fingernail represents the Sun. So Planet X is going to come in below the ecliptic disk, that ecliptic plane, and pass through the bottom of it, puncture the bottom of it, then travel over the top, loop over, coming toward the inner planets, looping over Mars, then coming closer in toward the center, looping over Earth, and then over Venus, and then over Mercury, the closest planet to the Sun. And finally, Planet X will loop over the Sun itself, and then come back down again like a pop fly ball. Going over the Sun and then coming back down into the ecliptic plane, probably around the same point as it came in, which would be between the asteroid belt and Jupiter. And I can show you a couple of pieces of evidence to indicate that that's where it probably will come in through the bottom, over the top, and come back down again.
So
comes over us and over the Sun. Once it goes over the Sun, are we done with it, or do we get it again as it comes back around the Sun?
We get it again. We get it twice.
Oh, excellent.
Now it depends on where we're at. So you see, now the Earth is that quarter that you're holding horizontally between your index finger and your thumb. That quarter is actually rotating like a compact disc would rotate. Now, if Earth is on inside that quarter somewhere, rotating in its little subcircle, its inner circle within the quarter, just like all the other planets are rotating around, you know, Jupiter might be rotating right along the edge of the quarter. Well, if we happen to be in that season of the year, say it's the spring, for example, when we're on the opposite side of where Planet X came in through the ecliptic plane, if it comes through the ecliptic plane from below, comes up, but we happen to be on the opposite side of the sun, then we'll be lucky. We won't get it so badly. We won't feel the repercussions as severely. If we happen to be close, you know, it'll be disastrous. But then we have to cross our fingers and pray on the downside, where this pop fly ball called Planet X comes over the sun and comes back down again. Where will we be in our annual orbit around the sun? If we're close to it, we'll get hit badly. It will be at gravitational and electromagnetic effects, damages due to electromagnetic attraction between Planet X and Earth, and due to gravitational attraction between Planet X and Earth. Planet X will never hit Earth. It's estimated to come as close as about 15 million miles away. Now, the sun is around 93 million miles away. So what is that, about six times? One-sixth the distance between the distance from the Earth to the sun. One-sixth that distance would be the closest distance that Planet X would pass by Earth. So that's essentially what's going to happen. Now, so now you know the path of Planet X, and you know how big it is. It's we said that Gilbert Erickson seems to have some pretty good information from insiders, whom I believe are in the government or within NASA. He believes that it's hard to tell. Nobody really even knows. I mean, only the people in the government have a good idea, because they're viewing this planet right as we speak. So Gilbert Erickson believes that it's about 10 times the size of Jupiter. Now, that would make it, by definition, if you look at the definitions of a brown dwarf star, which everybody, all the authorities, including NASA itself, has said in the past. I've got the newspaper articles before NASA was muzzled by the National Security Agency, spy agencies. NASA actually came out before they were muzzled back in the early 80s and said, yeah, we believe it's a brown dwarf star. Well, by definition, a brown dwarf star is at least, very bare minimum, the smallest it could possibly be would be 3 Jupiters in mass. Probably more like 10 Jupiters, that Gilbert Erickson has intuitively believes it's like 10 Jupiters, which would be not 318 Earth masses, as is Jupiter, but 10 times that, 3,180 Earth masses.
When you said about NASA watching it, or governments watching it, or whoever's watching it, that brings me to a question, and I get this question a lot when I'm talking to people about the subject. They ask, well, why haven't amateur astronomers around the world, why aren't we hearing reports from them? And I know that it's, you need a infrared supposedly to see it. So I looked at some infrared telescopes, and they're really not that much money. I don't know anything about looking into the stars. I don't know what strength is needed to see this. So I don't know if these infrared telescopes I was looking at would even, you know, have the ability to see it or not. So just thought I'd ask you that question.
Good question. You know, I haven't seen any amateur reports of it. I haven't been looking. You know, it's hard to search the internet completely, but I have a feeling that if an amateur astronomer does see it, as you said, he would have to have an infrared or even an X-ray telescope, because it's still shrouded with a lot of dust and it's not putting out very much light. But let's suppose that there are some amateur astronomers that are not, you know, people that have gotten visions of it or sightings of the planet and put it up on the internet. I would think that the governments of the world are all very diligently setting up a surveillance network of all the astronomers, all the private astronomers, and looking for anything. In fact, they could screen anything that goes up on YouTube or on the internet and immediately take it down.
John.
Oh, yes.
I have this program that alerts me to sun activity, and it's kind of funny. Well, actually, it may not be funny, but there was an alert that just came up that the CME that I was just telling you about that happened yesterday says that it may it shows an I'll read it right to you. I'm reading for the first time. It says the solar blast of August 7th might affect Earth after all. Newly arriving data from SOHO show an incoming CME with a significant Earth-directed component. High latitude sky watchers should be alert for auroras when the cloud arrives on the 10th and 11th. Today is the 9th.
Wow. Well, yeah, high auroras again, just like we had last week.
What concerns me about this is, you know, that what they called the solar tsunami on last week, that happened on a Sunday, and I was watching mainstream media for any report on it. There was really nothing until about 4 hours before it hit. And, you know, I was just thinking to myself, you know, they could be lying, you know, as far as the strength of this thing. And look at the timing of the mainstream report, 4 hours before it hits. You know, so, and with this CME, they've been reporting when it went off 2 days ago that it was really just going to glance off the planet. And now they're saying, oh, directly hit us. So it makes me wonder if the information they're getting, you know, if they don't really know, or if it's being held back, you know, for a little while.
All the major news outlets, television, print news, radio, they're all being tightly controlled by the government. Everything that comes out is sanitized, and the deceit. There's a deceit going on, and what you get is the most optimistic report. And usually they're very unimaginative in their deceit. What they do is they just try to ignore facts. And you'll see this all the time with the New World Order. Anytime there's something, incriminating or some information that is contrary to their agenda, they will just ignore it. And that's what they do here. Considering what you said before about, they only gave you a 4-hour warning that this thing was coming in when it should have been, you know, reported much earlier than that. They downplayed it too. They said, "Oh, it's not very bad." And James McCanney had also said, anybody who's talking about this subject and knows how the media operates, he said that you're going to have very little warning when you actually see that big, that glowing red comet in the sky. And, you know, it's going to be small at first, and every night it's going to get larger and larger, and they'll keep on lying to you. They'll say, oh, it's some kind of an aurora effect, or they'll make up some absurd lie. They know they won't fool the intelligent people, the ones who have are discerning and alert, but their concern is to fool as many of the masses, the ignorant masses, as possible. They have no ideal solution, because this is not an ideal situation. This is a catastrophic situation, even for the power elite to deal with, and with the Earth being destroyed from great powers in the heavens. So they themselves are scared, and lots of Planet X reporters and researchers are saying this, that they are very scared. They're going underground, and they're just doing a very sloppy, hasty job of deceiving us. So you're going to get lots of deception, and a lot of it will be absurd and unbelievably silly and foolish. But this tells you that
the distractions are at an all-time high right now. I mean, they're distracting you with Michelle Obama's extravagant trips. They're distracting you with mosques in New York. They're distracting you with oil disasters. They're distracting you with everything they possibly can.
That's a good point. That distraction, in addition to omitting the truth, they'll distract you from the truth. You're right. And so when you see the distraction index going higher, then you'll know something really bad. So you better be watching their left hand, which is behind their backs, to see what's really going on.